Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I mean, they did whatever they wanted. They double parked in front of a Waitrose. Nobody ever gave them a ticket. In the summer when they played croquet all night, nobody ever called the police. It was a glorious time. The Tories were all over the place. There was Rishi Rich. Mickey Smiths.
I'm addicted to public service.
And then there was the Bullingdon crew, Honest Johnson. And his guys, the Dominator, and Make Your Life Hell Patel. And then there was Matty Wanksock.
There's a reason I went on I'm a Celebrity, and the reason is because of the money.
And then you had Brains.
Opening up new pork markets.
And Red Tony.
Yeah, but just let me say one thing.
No. And the Piggy Fiddler, who got his nickname because he once put his penis in a dead pig's gob, allegedly. For us, to live any other way was nuts. Those goody-good people who worked shitty jobs for bum paychecks and took the bus to work every day, worried about their bills, were dead. They were suckers. They had no balls. If we needed money, we just claimed it on expenses. Or we made cuts to welfare, the police, or the NHS. It didn't matter. We ran everything. But now, it's all over. The Piggy Fiddler broke the nation's balls. Honest Johnson got ratted out. And then Brains whacked the pound. Now, I'm just your average backbencher. I get to spend the rest of my career on GB News.
Welcome to Free State, everybody. Joe, how long have you been living in this hotel?
I'm leaving you, you cow.
As Alan Partridge would say.
We were having coffee before this, and the manager of the hotel was brought over coffee for myself and Dio. And you see, I mean, they just treat me like a, you know, I mean, that's, I'm like, it's like being a family home. That's how they treat me. I've been here since April, but the manager was chatting to me and Dio, and Dio said, how do you get on with them in the hotel? And he says, he complained trenchantly. What did he say?
Relentlessly. He complains relentlessly.
Like Larry David. I was like, ring Big Dave and say, Big Dave, this Netflix isn't working properly. Is there something wrong with the Wi-Fi? He goes, it's 11:30 at night. He said, I'm a bit here. I said, the pictures, they had a various fault. She'd say, like, what the hell's what's going on here?
I think comparing like a family is up. He did say that you've been mentioned in some meetings.
Yeah, and I did. That's hilarious, getting mentioned at the board meetings.
I think, but, you know, so I did think of Alan Partridge. You know, it's obviously far superior to the travel tavern. But, yeah. You know, when he tells, you know, when he's finally moving out, you will be.
Nobody's graffitied my car.
No.
But I'm living here, obviously, because I've been privileged to be instructed for 10 of the families in Stardust, and we had, you know, it's just an unbelievably poignant day today.
And I mentioned this before as well, that, you know, it does remind me, I was at the Hillsborough inquest in Warrington in 2014, which I know Stardust has taken a lot of its modelling from, and how that was done.
Absolutely, I've been very, very impressed. But how long did you?
I spent a couple of days up there. I went up and back, but a couple of days, and just, but again, it like the similarities are huge because, you know, there are all those stories of people going to the match almost on a, because you could go to a match on a whim then, yeah. You know, and you could go.
You just go for a day's crack.
And you could go, not, you know. And they were all young, like the you know, and also that sense of it was there, the signs were there that this was going to happen, you know, like this had happened at Hillsborough before. It had, you know,
they were getting close. They were coming close a few years beforehand.
Like Tottenham had played there in an FA Cup semi final, and one of the supporters had written, I think, to the FA saying how dangerous it was, all this kind of stuff. But then the fact that it was, you know, that view of football supporters. As the enemy.
And sort of animals and bringing it on themselves and all that vile sort of stuff from the Sun.
The Sun also that came out after.
Let's call it the sort of that sort of Braverman stuff.
It's what you mentioned, Braverman, because it did tap in, and it tapped into, they didn't call them culture, and it was again more substantial than cultural, but there was this sense of, you know, a community that they could attack, because, you know, the Sun printed that story, Calvin McKenzie printed that story. That was advanced in certain quarters.
You wouldn't get away with that here.
No, but people
would be so outraged and horrified that you just wouldn't get away with
it. But the similarity is, the other similarity as well is between, Stardust, and you talk, you know, in the families and that sense of community and that sense of unity, and that was the thing that that came not just from the Hillsborough families, but they were central to it, but from the whole city of Liverpool, like that was the thing, and they never broke in that unity. And it was funny, we might play the clip of it, the Everton chairman Bill Kenwright, who died recently. And he made that fantastic speech at one of the anniversaries. And he was, you know, the chairman of Everton, but he was a huge figure on Merseyside. And he talked to he talked at Anfield. He came and addressed they had a service every year, and he talked about the Hillsborough families and the fight they'd kept up. And he talked about the mothers, because all these, you know, this is a tragedy. These were all young, you know, mainly young boys going to a football match, and their mothers were left to fight for justice.
True, these were all kids too.
And Bill Kenwright, we'll play this because it was amazing. He said, "They picked on the wrong city, and they picked on the wrong mums."
There were two words that were mentioned an awful lot, and resonated to me hugely. And I think, to me, they're the two most important words in the English language, certainly to people from Liverpool. That the two most important words in the English language. The words were, me mum. And all of us here are lucky enough. Some of us have got our mums beside us, but we've all got mums. And I saw your banner on Saturday at Reading saying, you've taken on the wrong city. Well, you've taken on the wrong mums too, because we all know about Liverpool mums and the way they fight for their kids and their family.
For me, the parallels are, you know, one of the sort of striking parallels is that it would have been easier. It would have been a lot easier, you know, to make football grounds safe. And it would have been a lot cheaper. And it would be a lot easier to have just left the Stardust safe. And, you know, the fact that so many, ranked about 22 people died within a sort of a 15-foot arc of emergency exits, 4 and 5. Mm-hmm. Because they were feet, 5, 6, 7 feet away, but just couldn't get out. And very like Hillsborough, you know, where people were desperately trying to drag people over those railings, you know, those railings that were coming up and then pointing back towards you so that you were underneath the railings and behind them. And people, you know, their lives being saved, you could see it happening. This person's going to live now. You know, all these things that we're talking about, Braverman, the, you know, what's happening in the UK and America and Israel, you know, it's a contempt for your fellow man. And I think that the media has played a very, very central role in that. The way the media has been bought, you know, the way it's been sort of, you know, controlled by the advertisers, by the oligarchs who own the media. And, you know, I keep coming back to the point that we have got to guard against these things really zealously. We have got to have absolute respect for the rule of law, absolute respect for the courts. That's why I don't like Simon Harris and people like that. And I like Simon attacking the courts, attacking the law, for example, in relation to defamation. So you say, well, it's having a chilling effect. Sinn Féin are using this. And that's well and good, right? They are using the law of the land, just in the same way as many Fine Gael, many Fianna Fáil people have sued various outlets over the last 20 years. You know, that is the law of the land. Now, you want to change the law of the land, then you do that through the Oireachtas. You know, you do it via democratic vote. You draft it up. If it's passed, then it's passed. Then all the courts do is to police the laws to make sure they don't infringe any other laws, to make sure that they comply with our legal obligations internationally. And then interpret the law. You know, so I do not like to see attacks on the law of the land.
Well, I take that point that, you know, we've disagreed about defamation. I mean,
we may think that the libel laws are far too generous to litigants, for example, or particularly to people who have a lot of money and who can afford to frighten a journalist, you know, or frighten anyone by serving proceedings on them. But we have to, and our politicians have to have respect for the law.
Well, I also think, you know, you're a politician in a party that's been in government for quite a while. You could actually just change the law. And like, there's no question that the defamation laws need to be changed, because the burden of proof it's on the defendant to the degree that when, you know, if you say certain, you know, Mr. A had a meeting with Mr. B, you get a letter from billionaire Mr. A saying this suggests that.
The billionaire is the word, but like, you know, squash that fly type of thing.
Yeah. And it says, in this article where you said I had a meeting with Mr. B, you're now suggesting, and you get these letters, and they're beautifully crafted, elegantly written works, and you read it and you go, did I say that? Is that what I was saying? But that then becomes almost the accepted truth, which you have to disprove, and that's the huge problem.
Well, just comply with the law, you know. If you don't defame anybody, it's fine.
No, but that's what the defamation. The burden of proof, you have to prove that you haven't defamed them in that situation, and it's very hard. But this is why I agree with you. Like, and you will accuse me of, you know, attacking Sinn Féin for whatever reason. But I am saying that I would agree with you in this situation.
You'll attack them whether I accuse you of that or not.
Stop holding my hand.
I will continue to attack Sinn Féin.
I will continue to.
At every opportunity.
No, but I would actually agree with you that I think this is an example of one of those situations where, while I would agree with the points, I would agree with somebody saying that Sinn Féin shouldn't be doing this, or Sinn Féin politicians shouldn't be doing this. I don't think politicians should be suing journalists. I don't think journalists should be suing journalists. But I think it's something that this is clearly, you know, change the fucking law. Don't be giving out about Sinn Féin doing it. Change the law and do something. Yeah. This is opportunism to attack Sinn Féin about it when you actually have the power to change the defamation laws. But let's talk about Britain today.
Yeah, I thought you wanted to talk about one of our favourite people in this podcast, who we hope to have on in due course. Suella Braverman and what she exemplifies.
Well, you see, I want to go back to this because we talked about this on Tuesday and what has happened in England. And it is a really interesting, because, you know, I left England in 2016, and now there'll be lots of people who would feel this is a simplified version of it, but it was It's a pretty normal. I left in March 2016, and all seemed normal. Everything seemed pretty normal. Mm. Well, you know, you talk about when you
the condition forward. The condition that you were in when you left.
England. No, I was
almost
fine.
Anything would almost anything would have seemed normal.
I was fine then. But it was you know, there were to a certain extent there were serious people. Are less unserious people running things. And, you know, the Brexit campaign was happening at that stage.
It really nosedived.
But what is extraordinary about this, and I was going back and looking at this and looking at the formation of, and we know an awful lot about, you know, how the media demonized the EU and all this, but there is also a sense of, and we talked about this on Tuesday's show about Boris Johnson and that sense of never wanting to take anything too seriously or never being really engaged or feeling that there was something boring.
That's because he doesn't care about other people.
But I think there's also a sense, and I want to come back. Sorry,
why sit down and patiently construct a policy for the good of people?
But
listen, just let me finish.
Okay.
When you don't care about those people, any difference to you. Sure, if you can have an easy win from it and you can do something simply that isn't that overly taxing and you can make an announcement. Of course, you could then make the opposite announcement the next day. But, I mean...
Let me finish the point I want to make about this, because I think this started a long time ago with Britain, and it goes back, you know, to when that Eurosceptic idea took hold and developed, and it developed in the wake of Thatcher resigning and John Major coming in, and the Maastricht Treaty being the starting point, and this idea of Europe as the enemy. And I was looking back over that period ahead of the podcast, and I found a quote from Kim Darroch, who was a Foreign Office diplomat, when John Major emerged from the Maastricht negotiations and got a deal which gave Britain a number of opt-outs. So this sense of Britain always being sort of
special
and different, and sort of slightly at
Great
Britain. Slightly at an angle with the rest of Europe. And this quote reminded me very much of somebody we've been talking a lot about. He said, "It felt that we were building a kind of model to British exceptionalism. It felt that we were building a kind of model to British exceptionalism in the new European landscape, that we were able to have it both ways." Now, who was it who came up with cakeism? The idea that having your cake and eating it.
Cakeism. I never heard that before.
That was Boris Johnson. He was pro having your cake and pro eating. It was one of his little witticisms. So again, he never had to make a hard decision. But the interesting thing about this is that was his personality and his character, but it was also something that developed from Maastricht in 1991, 1992 for 25 years.
I get that. And, you know, then it was an easy sell. This was, you know, Britain's being overrun and, you know, Great Britain, and we can go back to being great again, and we can be a powerhouse, and we can do all these weird things like cut taxes but improve the lot of people in society. All these fantasies. But the essential quality... The essential quality of the modern Tory party is shamelessness. Mm.
The Times let you go after you made up a quote. Why did you make up a quote?
Well, this again, you know, these are big terms for what happened. Well, I can tell you the whole thing. I mean, are you sure our viewers wouldn't want to hear more about what happened was that. I ascribed events that were supposed to have taken place before the death of Piers Gaveston to events that actually took place after the death
of
Piers
Gaveston. Let me ask you about another little...
I mildly sandpapered something somebody
said. Let me ask you about a barefaced lie.
It's very embarrassing, I'm very sorry about it.
Let me ask you about a barefaced lie. When you were in Michael Howard's team, you denied to him you were having an affair. It turned out you were. And he sacked you for that. Why did you lie to your party?
Well, with great respect, on that, I never had any conversation with Michael Howard about that matter, and, I don't...
You did lie. Propose,
I don't propose to go into all that again.
I don't blame you.
No, well, why should I? Why don't we talk about something else?
Well, this is about your integrity.
Okay.
The programme includes your reaction as you listen to a phone call in which your friend Darius Guppy asks you to supply the address of a journalist so that he can have him physically assaulted. The words beaten up and broken ribs are said to you. And you, having heard that, you tell your friend, Darius Guppy, you will supply the address. What does that say about you, Boris Johnson?
Well,
aren't you, in fact, making up quotes, lying to your party leader, wanting to be part of someone being physically assaulted? You're a nasty piece of work, aren't you?
Well, I think all three things I would dispute.
But even Conrad Black, your friend, convicted fraudster, even he says he doesn't trust you completely.
I hadn't seen that Conrad had said that, but obviously, nonetheless, I've got a great admiration for Conrad, who, in my view, is a pretty good journalist.
You know, the essential quality for any human being who has, you know, who has concern for others and who has, you know, who is interested in society and people's well-being is a sense of shame. You know, you feel a sense of shame, whether it's, you know, in personal relationships or in your wider community. You know, if you know where the line is, and when you go over that line, if you don't feel a sense of shame, then you can pass go and join the Tory party. And, you know, we see this very vividly now in America with, you know, the rise of this lunatic, which used to be a fringe, you know, it used to be the sort of the Boston Tea Party fringe, this lunatic sort of Republican Party now, which is scary and capable of almost anything. And as you continue to smash through those barriers of decency and of honesty and integrity and all of these people are promoted who are shameless. You know, that was for me the most important thing that came out of the COVID inquiry. The absolute shamelessness of these people. You know, Priti Patel, Suella Braverman, Boris, Dominic Cummings. No personal responsibility taken for anything. You know, could quite easily attack anybody without any loyalty whatsoever. I mean, Suella Braverman was hardly out the door. I mean, imagine her being made the Home Secretary of anything.
Yeah.
The secretary of anything, but she was hardly out the door when she was attacking Rishi Sunak, you know, and...
I trusted you. That was what her letter said. I trusted you. And, you know, again, there used to be a saying that the right looked for converts while the left looked for traitors. But it actually, it's all to do with any fundamentalist, like... The entire right wing of the Tory party, which is, you know, such a the majority of it today, is constantly on the lookout for betrayal. It is always on the... Because betrayal is, again, when you talk about things like personal responsibility and just a shamelessness, if you can accuse people of betrayal, it's a great cop-out. And her letter to Rishi Sunak was one of the great... letters of let me create this sense of you. Here are you now, a traitor to the things we.
You know what really galls me too. What really galls me is, no matter how unsavory, you know, and they're seriously unsavory. All of them, no matter how unsavory they are, once they get this promotion, you know, precisely because they are unsavory and prepared to say anything. I mean, like, you know, Robert Jenrick. After the Supreme Court unanimously, all five judges ruled that the new Rwanda legal scheme was completely unlawful. Right, Robert Jenrick went on to the BBC and said, "We won." He's like, "What? We won?" And that is now precisely the quality that's required to just lie, you know, cleverly. James Cleverly, Priti Patel, they will quite literally say anything that they're told to say. Individual conscience is irrelevant. I mean, Keir Starmer this week warned his shadow cabinet members that if any of them voted in favour of a ceasefire, they would be sacked. Mm. If you vote for a ceasefire, the cessation of the mass bombing and shooting of defenceless civilians, you will be sacked. And that is an example, a very vivid example of how corrupted politics is becoming. And that's our closest neighbour.
But it's
and I worry very much when I see Micheál Martin, see Fianna Fáil inviting, you know, the vile hate-filled, because that's what she is. She's a hate-filled person, you know, who doesn't appear to have any moral code whatsoever.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Inviting her to the Ardèche, sitting her in the VIP seats. Micheál Martin traveling to Israel to take part in, you know, or if he wasn't doing it willingly, he certainly looked as though he was, wearing his IDF top, you know, being toured around sort of what looked very much like, you know, he was a prop in an Israeli propaganda play, you know, which was then transmitted out. Micheál told them that he stood with Israel and all the rest of it. I mean, it's just so soul-destroying and corrupting. I mean, what is that? You explain that to me. I really genuinely... I could not believe it. I mean, at the back of the Stardust inquest, when the photos started to circulate, you could see people all looking around at each other.
Mm.
Seriously? Seriously?
I want to talk about, we've just come back to what you said.
Yes,
about
but it's all part of this moral corruption. You know, why is it? Why is it that slowly and steadily throughout Europe, America, et cetera, we have these leaders now in these political parties who, and I think a big answer to that question is that there is a lot of oligarchs' money now, a lot of lobby money that's steering politicians in certain directions, and increasingly they're being disconnected from the population, from the citizenry, and the citizenry really just becomes a pawn in their game.
Well, everything is... You know, and this is the thing, and this is the extraordinary thing about Britain, because, you know, a move from Europe being the bogeyman to anybody who got in the way was a bogeyman. So we've had the enemies of the people in the past with the courts, and we've had it again now with the Rwandan decision, and you had Lord Sumption, who isn't some...
Would be seen as a deeply conservative figure, but an ingenious lawyer.
Yeah, and he describes...
What a great name, Lord Sumption.
Lord Sumption.
Sumptuous. The sumptuous Lord Sumption.
If
I was a lord, what would I call myself? What would my title be?
Lord
Brawley of... Not Lord Brawley of Benedy or something like that.
Lord Brawley of...
Brawley of... You know, it'd have to be something grand.
It would be grand. You'd have to go grand. Yes, we've sort of talked before.
Anyway, we'll
work on that. We'll work on what you call yourself. If you ever, it's unlikely.
Yes.
Not that you're not Brawley. Deserving.
We're joined now by Lord Brawley.
Lord Brawley has joined us.
On the now that RT are apparently going to lose the Sunday game, it's going to be tendered out to the market.
Is it?
Yes. Lord Brawley could be back on television. just when you thought it was safe.
But he, Lord Sumption, not Lord Brawley, described
Lord Sumptious.
He said that it was profoundly discreditable, the plan to use a law to declare Rwanda as safe. He said it was constitutionally really quite extraordinary because, he argued, it would effectively overrule a decision on the facts, on the evidence by the highest court in the land. I've never heard of a situation... in which Parliament intervenes to declare the facts, to change the facts from those that have been declared by the court to be correct. And for Parliament simply to say the facts are different would be constitutionally really quite extraordinary.
You're accused of describing the Rwanda system as batshit. Is that true? Did you say those words?
Well, I think the Rwanda scheme is great. I think it's great. I think it's legal. Well, you know, it will be legal when we change the law. And we fully respect the Supreme Court and we're addressing the problem. So the Supreme Court have said that Rwanda is an unsafe country. Well, what we're going to do is change the definition of unsafe country. And Rwanda is a safe country as long as you're not a critic of the government. You know, if you're a critic of the government, you can end up in prison, therefore, for, most of your life. Or, you know, if you you can be chased out of the country and killed, but not if you don't criticise the government. So that to us, you know, that is a safe country. And so we are happy to change that language and call it what it is. And it is that because we're saying it is, you know.
Very happy to give you the time to answer the question I just asked you is, did you say that word?
Well, Charlie, I don't know if I said that. I don't know if I said those words. But again, if I did say that, those are just words and words can be changed. And they are changing now as I speak to you because this is a conversation and conversation contain words that change all the time. And sometimes in a conversation, you override the other person. I'm not overriding you now, but, you know, if we were in a conversation with the Supreme Court, well, we've overridden them because as much as we respect them, what the people want is us to stop the boats and to stop the laws. So that's what we're doing.
That's it in a nutshell. I mean, one of the things that's very striking about the UK Supreme Court judgment and the Supreme Court, you know, which I've appeared before, a very, very interesting experience, is that, you know, they are the last sort of gatekeepers. They're the last gatekeepers in society, and they are the only thing, really. I mean, you know, if the Tories could do what the grand old party in America is trying to do with the Republican Party, they would. That's what they're trying to do. Mm. I mean, they were delighted watching the riots at the Cenotaph, the attacks on the police officers by the far right, the EDL, who are now. You know, being described openly as patriots, English patriots. Mm. But the Supreme Court, and I've never seen this before, the Supreme Court was moved to say at paragraph 2 of their very elegant 56-page ruling, which no doubt you've read, Dio, in preparation for this podcast, they were moved to say at paragraph 2, right, in this appeal, the court is required to decide whether the Rwanda policy is lawful. This is a legal question. The court must decide it on the basis of evidence and the established legal principles. This court is not concerned with the political debate surrounding the policy, and nothing in this judgment should be regarded as supporting or opposing any political view of the issues. And this is because the Supreme Court has been roundly attacked by the Tories when they said, for example, that Parliament had been unlawfully prorogued.
Yeah.
You know, it was open season in the media. Again, it's been open season in the media by the Tories in relation to the Supreme Court. And what they would attempt to do should they somehow manage to remain in power, which I think is extremely unlikely at this point and probably impossible, you know, the long-term plan will be to dismantle the independence of the Supreme Court. Because you've got to dismantle it. So in the same way that the US Supreme Court has been thoroughly infiltrated by billionaire money, dark money, as very, very sort of clearly illustrated by Sheldon Whitehouse, the senator from Maine, his crusade in relation to the corrupting of the Supreme Court. I mean, that's the real game here. You know, you corrupt the courts, create a partisan Supreme Court. Now you're in business. Oh, yeah, send them to fucking Rwanda, you know. You know what? The plebs love it. the knuckle draggers and the people who attack the Cenotaph, they love it. Send the fucking black bastards out to Rwanda, you know. Send the fucking Asians back to Rwanda. Oh, I mean, did you see the hate that was on display? You can't, all of you. Yeah. You know, the absolute hatred.
Terrorist fuckers, man.
Yeah, you terrorist cunt.
Go on, keep going. Who are you, you cunt?
And, you know, and this is now what passes for a Tory government, you know, harnessing the worst elements of society to champion laws and policies which are disgustingly inhumane.
Well, I think on that bombshell, I'm going to just cut that. I don't use bombshell.
You don't have to cut that.
Well, I did think...
Can you not say bombshell anymore?
No, you can't say bombshell. I just didn't.
Alan Partridge said, on that bombshell. Okay. Aha! Okay, on that bombshell. Yeah. It's on goodbye from me, Alan Partridge. And goodbye from you.
I wanted to ask you before you go that if you did, because I was struck, and I agree with what you said there, but the two aspects of it. So Ella Braverman, of course, was sacked then by Rishi Sunak, and James Cleverly has come in. And the Tories had these little kind of posters all made up for all of them as if it was kind of transfer deadline day. And James Cleverly's slogan underneath his caption was, "We'll stop the boats." Oh, you know, indeed. "We'll stop the boats." But then he had to deny, he didn't deny, he was asked if he had privately referred to the Rwanda scheme as batshit.
And so instead of providing safe routes, they'll let people drown. And that's what's been happening. Yeah. They'll allow precious human beings to drown.
Yeah.
And they will revel in this. They will say, well, you know, it's their own fault and they shouldn't be coming here. And, you know, we did offer to send them to Rwanda, one of the most grotesque sort of human rights offenders in the world. You know, why would they not want to go to Rwanda or live in a barge, which is completely saturated with Legionnaires' disease? What the hell is wrong with these people?